there, friends. It's us. That's right. Thank you for joining us here again on Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam Hale, as always, sitting here across the table from me. We've been laughing all afternoon today. Hope it starts off everybody's week wonderful. But sitting here with me is a special guest. That special guest is master of the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Turtle Guard, Mr. Kyle Filson.
Hello, everybody. I'm doing excellent. Cam, what are you up to, buddy?
Man, oh man. The fights this weekend were great. Hats off to Mr. Stipe Biosic. Great fight. Everything was wonderful. I hope that Alistair's okay, but everything was good. So congrats to everybody out there listening from Ohio and all you Cleveland listeners. Yeah, there he is. Champ again.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was putting it on folks this weekend. But yeah, everything's good. Hope everybody is having a wonderful, wonderful start of the week. Let's get the ball rolling. I've got a question for you, Mr. Filson.
Yeah, please.
I need you to think back for me.
Okay.
You were 22 years old.
Okay.
What were you doing with your life at 22?
I was going out with my jackass friends. I was drinking a lot, sleeping late, skipping school. Nothing responsible.
It was nothing constructive?
Not really, no.
Really, just pretty much letting down the whole world, weren't you?
Yeah, I don't think I was doing much to benefit mankind.
I was pretty much doing the same, except I had a child. I was raising a child, which I should have never been in charge of, but that's pretty much what was going on. But I tell you what I wasn't doing. I wasn't inventing something that could save millions of people. Folks, this comes from the BBC. And my hat's off again to all you British folk. There is a 22-year-old British student that invented a mobile fridge that they say could save millions of lives across the world.
Really?
Michael Baggs actually talked about this, wrote about this. It says, Will Broadway's Isobar has been designed to keep vaccines at the ideal temperature while in transit in developing countries. And Will doesn't plan to make any money from his creation.
Well, that's good.
Now, Will is an industrial design and technology graduate from Loughborough University, and he's talking the news beat when they were asking him these questions. And this is what he says. I make things every day for people who have everything. That's why he said he's not trying to get a patent. But he says, I wanted to make something for people who have next to nothing. It should be a basic human right, in my opinion, to have a vaccination. I don't think that it should be patented to restrict use. And he goes on to say that his Isobar won him the annual James Dyson Award, open to students across the world with a simple brief, design something that solves problems. Now, it says that current methods of transporting vaccines can result in the vaccines freezing before reaching their destination in countries where poverty and conflict are very large major obstacles.
Right.
Now, the device maintains a steady 2 to 8 degrees for 30 days. It works by heating ammonia and water to create ammonia vapors, which are then released into its main chamber when cooling is needed. Will was inspired to start work on a portable refrigeration unit in 2012, he says, when he visited Cambodia and parts of Southeast Asia. This is what he said. These trips sparked an interest. It pushed me. Something needs to be solved for this major issue. Now, he says precisely that he worked at a medical device consultancy and that his firsthand experience of how large companies monetize life-saving products. He said medical products have such a big markup that it's unreasonable for people around the world to purchase these items.
Right.
And that if it's the best thing available, then it should be out there saving lives. Now, it's been estimated that his invention could save the lives of 1.5 million people across the world. Now, Will himself believes that that's an astonishing number.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? Now, he says that he's finished his degree. He's going to take the Isobar into production, and it's something that he plans to oversee. He said it would be hands-on himself all the way through it, knowing that it works. It's amazing to just go give it a go, he said, in my backyard, and then to see the potential of this technology. Now, he says blood donations, organ transplants, if they get stuck in traffic, you'll still see cold packs that aren't really adequate for long periods of time. So basically they're saying that they still use them. So what he's wanting to do is kind of branch this out to use everything. He said, it's risky, but there is potential for commercial cooling. It would be a great thing to take on a 5-day trip when you have no power. But he insists.
So it's like a cooler. It's like
basically,
yeah. Yeah, like a cooler that keeps things cold for 30 days?
Well, right now, no. No. Not I'm taking that back. Yes, it's 30 days for the size that he has.
Right.
And it's not very big. If you see it, it's a little bit bigger than an American football, the little cooler that it has. Because you're talking about just holding little vaccine things in it.
I gotcha.
But he does insist that the delivery is the primary function of his invention. This is what he says. It has been applied to what is hopefully the right avenue for the technology. So even as a 22-year-old student, this kid is changing the world. He's going out there. He's found something that people need, and he's building it open source. This is how it works. Let's get the people to using these things.
Yeah, and he's not trying to profit from it.
No, not at all.
That is the rarest thing, I think.
Exactly.
In today's world, no one does. You know, like the guy that invented the polio vaccine stuff. They said nowadays that was something similar to that. All these corporations would own it, and they would profit billions on it. He gave it away for free. He's like, look, man, this is not something to make money off of. This is for humanity.
I think a lot of people get lost in that.
I think nowadays it's really hard to do anything where the people don't charge money.
Yes.
I mean, even we give away a free show every Monday.
Yeah.
You know? So, very cool. That is really cool, especially for a 22-year-old.
22. That's amazing.
That's amazing. Well, speaking of something else that's amazing, check this out. Evidence of a 9,000-year-old stone house has been found on an Australian island.
Mm.
Now, archaeologists working on the Dampier Archipelago off Australia's northwest coast have found evidence of stone houses dating back 9,000 years to the end of the last ice age, building the case for the area to get a World Heritage listing. Recently, circular stone foundations were discovered on Rosemary Island, which is the outermost of 42 islands that make up the archipelago. The islands and nearby Burrup Peninsula are known as Murujuga, a word meaning hip bones sticking out, in the language of the Garluma people. Now, Professor Joe McDonald, director of the Center for Rock Art Research and Management at the University of Western Australia, said the excavations showed occupation was maintained throughout the Ice Age and the period of rapid rise in sea levels that followed. Now, she went on to say, around 8,000 years ago, these homes would have been on the coast. This is the time that the islands were starting to be cut off, and it's a time when people were starting to rearrange themselves. The sea level on Australia's northwest coast rose 130 meters after the end of the Ice Age, at a rate of about a meter every 5 to 10 years. In people's lifetimes, they would have seen loss of territory and would have had to renegotiate, a bit like Miami is doing these days. Research done in the past 12 months has found evidence of human occupation in Murujuga dating back 21,000 years, or before the last ice age. Now, earlier research on Barrow Island, which is about 100 kilometers west, found evidence of human occupation dating back 50,000 years. Now, the Western Australian government is facing increased pressure to support a World Heritage application for the area, which has been on the National Heritage Register since 2007. There are 2,500 registered Aboriginal heritage sites on the Burrup Peninsula right now and the surrounding islands, which are located near Karratha, which is 1,525 kilometers north of Perth. So that's pretty cool, right? To find these structures that long ago and even dating that humans were living in that area 50,000 years ago. See, because what they're saying is before the last ice age, the land was continuous all the way from like the south of Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, all that, all the way down through Indonesia and everything, all the way to Australia. It was all connected. And when the seas rose, that's why
it separated.
Everything is underwater nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So really very interesting that there was people living in that part of the world back then. It always makes me wonder what could be under the ocean, you know, in those areas, what there might be, what structures might there be, what ancient temple that's greater than all the ones that we've found so far might be under there, right?
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
I like it that it's seen more and more people, and we've talked about it and actually got a lot of emails and messages and stuff from professors and even archaeologists and things that have listened to the show. But I like the fact that it seems like everybody's getting on board with saying, hey, we really didn't know or don't know as much about the history that we thought we did, and we're finding older and older things. So because of that, we're just going to kind of say we don't know, and we're going to go back to learning. And it seems like that's kind of getting to be the mantra now, instead of everybody being stuck in the dogma of the way it's supposed to be.
I think you're right. And I think it's because of the digital age. I think it's because of the internet that these people are growing up now in a completely different world than what we had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you were a kid, when we were in school, I mean, you were told just to listen to professor or listen what's in the textbook and not to question anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like that's the way, which is a good thing.
Yeah, everybody's learning together, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
I agree, man. Pretty cool.
Speaking of learning together, I got you something pretty crazy here that we had talked last week on the Elite Show a little bit about some robot learning, and I thought I would bring this up. This comes from Japan Times. Hitachi starts trials of, and I don't even know how to go about pronouncing this, so I'm just going to, it's EMIEW3. I don't know if there's a certain way they want to say it, but anyway, it's a humanoid robot at the Haneda Airport. Now, they started these trials of this humanoid at Tokyo's Haneda Airport this past Friday, and the reason being was to aid foreign visitors to Japan. Now, it says, during the trials through December in the airport's domestic Terminal 2, the robot will communicate with passengers in Japanese and English at a designated information center, as well as a display on it, I guess personally on it, for information. Now, it says, of course, here that the conglomerate there, the Hitachi, is hoping to enable that the 90-centimeter-tall humanoid robot with autonomous capabilities, is what they're looking for it to do, guide users to destinations starting around December. So they're going to go ahead and release it so it can be the, like when you go up there and ask for help or where is this place or where is this, it's going to take you to it. So this past Friday, there was a demonstration. There was a foreign female passenger, and she asked the robot for directions at the foreign exchange counter. The humanoid robot, says at the information center, called another EMIEW3 robot to take her to the location. The robot responds, please follow me. And then she follows it, and it takes her to where she wants to go. Now, it says, since the introduction of this style of robot, the EMIEW1, started in 05, it says Hitachi's been improving on its capabilities, and that this newest one has what they call, in this article, a remote brain that can process images and voices. And this was unveiled in April. But here you go again. Multiple robots can be linked with the use of a remote operation systems, according to Hitachi. Now, Hiroshi Sato, now he's the senior vice president and executive officer at Hitachi. And he says that we are hoping to use the EMIEW3 to assist efforts to extend hospitality at Haneda Airport through our trial runs. And the reason being is there's been an influx of foreign visitors to Japan and that they need it for these extra services. Now, Sato goes on to say that they are hoping to increase the number of languages it speaks to include Chinese and Korean. So it's going to be able to recognize what language you're speaking to it, know what you're asking, and then in turn retort sensibly and work with you and then take you where you need to go.
So this is going to be like a robotic TSA agent, right?
Pretty much,
that's just patrolling the airport?
It's not going to like pat you down and grope you, which is kind of sad. But
it's got 3D imaging. It can see through your clothes and everything. It's like Ed 209, right, from Robotech.
So this,
or RoboCop.
Yeah, this is what's coming. So we're going to, and I imagine, you know, you can kind of envision this, if you will, as you're going to see robots. Probably that's where they're going to start, is at the airport. You're going to see a ton of them. Something to do with transportation, like we talked about the Johnny Cab and we talked about all this stuff, is it's going to get to the point to where all public transportation is going to be ran by robots. Why? Because it can run nonstop and it can run cheaper than paying people. The sad thing is it's going to put people out of a job.
Yeah.
Now, you will need programmers and you'll still need mechanics to keep the equipment running, things like that. But the people that drive the buses, the trams, the trains, the taxis, that stuff's going to be gone. We won't have that anymore.
Man, that is scary. And if that's not scary enough, check this out when it comes to robotics.
Yay.
World's first nano fish
coming
to swim drugs up your bloodstream. Check this out, Cam.
Researchers, I'm glad you said bloodstream. I thought you was going someplace else with that.
No, researchers at UC San Diego have created the first nano fish, the New Scientist reports, a magnet-powered bot that they hope to use for targeted delivery of medication, non-invasive surgery, and single-cell manipulation. Now, developed by Jinjing Li and his team at the University of California, these new nanobots are 100 times smaller than a grain of sand.
Whoa!
And they consist of tiny gold and nickel segments that are connected with silver hinges. Now, an external magnet is used to manipulate the nickel and create a waving motion to propel the bot forward. The speed and direction of the little swimmer is determined by the orientation and strength of the magnetic field. Ultimately, the team hopes that the remarkable invention will be able to deliver drugs like pain medication to a specific area of the body that needs it. And while other scientists have developed nano swimmers for the same potential purposes, most of those experimental models are more like submarines than they are like fish. Traditionally, bacteria's corkscrew tail has been the design inspiration for helical propellers that move a nanobot through the bloodstream. But experiments have shown that this nanofish is actually more efficient. Now, Lee goes on to say that they're working on a biodegradable version. So very soon, Cam, they're going to have these super small robotics fish-like things that are going to swim through your bloodstream to remove blood clots, to take medication to certain areas. How long until they're in there, millions of little tiny ones, and they're like repairing your heart valve or something? I mean, this is so sci-fi, yet it's real, and it's happening right now, that it just blows your mind. I mean, what is it going to be like 50 years from now?
I'm more freaked out by how do they build them?
Yeah, right.
How do you build something hinged that you know is going to work that well that's 100 times smaller than a grain of sand? How do you make that?
I have no idea.
That's got to be some off-earth technology that's constructing those things. How do you do that? You know what I mean? How the hell do you make a tiny metal fish?
Do I know
fish?
What you mean? Look at me. Just look at me. Do you think I know the answer to that?
I'm not sure you could just build me a metal fish with, I don't care what size it was.
Exactly. I have no idea, but it is incredible. That you're going to be able to go to the doctor, they're going to shoot you up, and you're just, I mean, it's going to heal you from the inside out.
And it's, you know what, we always talk about Ray Kurzweil, and the things that he said is the people that live forever have already been born.
I think you
it
might
makes
be right.
You wonder. You're like, you know what, if you can start, the thing is what I'm wondering is when are we going to reach that point to where people are like, okay, because this is probably something that's a little off base, but nobody wants to do this. Don't clone this. Don't clone that. Right. Let's don't play God. Until it's you or your child.
Yes.
And then you're like, go ahead and clone that for my kid. I don't want my kid to die. Go ahead and clone
it. Right.
Well, when are we going to drop the barriers and just be like wild westing it, you know, where they start just growing ears on pigs and, you know, all the stuff that they're doing, like, where everybody's got their own heart and they got their own liver and everything, and people are just, because you know where it's going to go. Once we know we can live forever, the hedonism and the debauchery that's going down is going to be off the chain. With the human race, we're going to go crazy. Because if you know that you could eat all you want, drink all you want, smoke all you want, you're just going to rock and roll till those organs play out.
Right.
And then it's just like, just driving a car without changing the oil till it redlines.
Doesn't matter.
Boom.
Just get it fixed. Man,
and then somebody gives you a free motor and you put it back in there and go again.
Yeah. I mean, all the time I'm always thinking, man, I wish I was born a long time ago, how simpler life would be. But now I'm starting to reconsider.
Yeah. I don't think that we're going to have those issues. Because if they're starting now, I'm thinking in another 20 years, maybe they'll be able to shoot some copper fish in me, fix me up.
Yeah. Why am I always trying to watch my weight and stuff like that? It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Just eat what you want.
Just eat what you want.
Just go crazy.
Just go crazy. People.
Yeah, to start drinking and smoking. They'll fix you later. It's
yeah, don't
fine.
Worry about it. Don't worry about it. What are we going to be talking about on today's show?
I'm going to do a little crypto stuff that's going to have a little crypto in the islands, folks. That's where I'm going to leave that. So when we come back from the break, we're going to dive off into some blue water crypto creatures, if you know what I'm talking about. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. All right, folks, thanks for joining us back here on the backside. I'm going to climb into this little story here. I guess in order to start this all off, I need to tell y'all just what put me on this path of inquiry. A few weeks back, a listener of the show sent me a direct link to a little vacation spot and was asking me about fishing it and swimming in it, mainly to give me a hard time, but it did pique my interest. Now, I had heard of this site before. But it was like a lot of things in our lives. We hear about it, but we're really not listening, if you know what I mean. Kind of comes and goes. Anyhow, I was reading some about it when this little article jumped out at me. It's always seemed so funny to me that when you're into something like the things we're all into, it has a way of showing up when you least expect it, or at least when you're really not looking for it. But that being said, I'm going to talk about a place that I've personally never been. But I am now planning on going. The place I'm talking about is the birthplace of MMA pioneer Eves Edwards, who became a Texan at the age of 15, might I add. And it's also the birthplace of another MMA fighter, the late Kevin Ferguson, better known as Kimbo Slice. That's right, y'all. I'm talking about the beautiful little chain of more than 700 islands and inlets in the Atlantic Ocean. Its capital is Nassau, there on the island of New Providence. I'm talking about the 180,000 square mile ocean space known simply as the Bahamas. Now, it was the site, known for the site there, as the Columbus's first landfall in the New World. Now, they did say that the Spanish never really colonized the Bahamas, but they used it more of a slavery depot, if you will, where they would haul the natives out of there and sell them off But it didn't really become, I guess, colonized until the English started settling there. And that was usually after about 1648, I'm sorry. But anyway, the story starts on this whole Bahaman island known as Isabella. Now, it seems that during his journey to the New World, Christopher Columbus had a very strange encounter with some mysterious serpent there, and he killed it, and he even documented the encounter. Columbus's diary entry from October 21st of 1492 describes how he had killed and later skinned a 5-foot-long creature that he described as a serpent. He tells how he and his crew had seen this creature on a lake on the island. He also documents that the next day a similar serpent was killed in another lake on the island, that same island, matter of fact, by Martin Alonso Pinzon, and he was the captain of one of the ships under Columbus's command. Now, both men had become monster hunters without really even knowing it, but like most great encounters of the past, it was all lost. You see, sadly, both of these alleged serpents were never properly preserved, so it's impossible to know just what kind of animals they were actually killed. And there's this. Back in Columbus's day, the term serpent could and often was applied to not only large snakes, but to practically anything large and reptilian. Lizards were deemed serpents, crocodiles, serpents. They even called the mythical dragons serpents. Now, this fact kind of dirties the report a bit, I guess, when you're looking for answers in this diary entry. Mainly because Columbus could have killed an actual crypto creature, like, say, a giant snake, or some giant or at least larger than normal lizard, maybe even some Bahamas-style alligator. And strangely enough, that's where our story leads us. See, there was an expedition in 1987 to the ruins of a little village on Isleta. It was this village that is believed to have been visited by Columbus himself. And it was there that Florida State Museum's assistant curator Bill Keegan uncovered the remains of an alligator. It has since been suggested that the serpent described by Columbus might have actually simply been an alligator, which, interestingly enough, were previously unknown to have ever inhabited the Bahamas. So it was a crypto encounter, I guess, after all. But however, the presence of alligator bones in a village that Columbus just happened to have visited is far, far from concrete evidence to the link the alligator remains to the diary entry. And so what exactly was killed on that day, long, long ago, still remains a mystery. But another strange tale pops up in history and goes that while in the Caribbean, on September 1494, Columbus and his crew were sailing along the east coast of the Dominican Republic. And it was there that they apparently sighted what all described as a gigantic turtle the size of a whale. And it had a very long tail and fins on its side. And it was also described as pushing through the water while keeping its head above the water. Now, all of that was just a side note, basically. Back to what I was sent. I was sent the story of the largest of the Bahamas island, the Andros. And on this island, there's a little mystery. They're referred to as the Blue Holes. Andros is a very beautiful spot on this planet of ours. And if you do a quick Google search of images of this paradise, It's easy to see why one would be drawn to such a place. Warm, crystal clear waters that are full of colorful sea life, and some of these are even found nowhere else on Earth. And if we move inland on the island, the scenery turns into these rocky little tide pools and mud flats and mangrove swamps. And you could only imagine the amount of biodiversity in such a very small area. And speaking of biodiversity, Andros also lays claim to this, the world's third largest barrier reef, and enormous freshwater aquifers around there, and the only freshwater river in all of the Bahamas. Now, among all of this is perhaps, like I said, the most mysterious feature of the island, the blue holes that speckle the island both in the sea and inland. Now, these blue holes are circular in nature and underwater caves. Now, some even say sinkholes, but technically they are this, vertical caves. And they descend down to depths of 100 meters, all the way down to 392 meters. So, folks, that's 330 feet down to 1,286 feet. Now, the blue holes are named because of the contrast between the dark blue water of their depths and the lighter colored shallow water that surrounds them. Much like when you're in the clear waters and you can see where the edge starts dropping in the dark water, especially down in Florida and things. Now, the inland blue holes always tend to look a little bit more of a perfect circle because they're darker and they look a little bit blacker too. And that's mostly due to rotting vegetation in those holes. Now, it's been estimated to be around 50 of these blue holes scattered throughout the shallows around Andros, and around 175 of them in the wooded interior of that very island. But there are also more being uncovered all the time. Now, many of these holes branch off into submerged passages and extensive underwater cave systems that twist and turn off in all directions for thousands of feet. Now, the blue holes of the Bahamas have always been the focus of mysterious speculation. And although popular places for divers and visitors to the island, it is believed that less than 1% of the underwater cave system of the Bahamas have been explored. And it has only been within the last few decades that there has even been any studies done to the holes. And it's first these few decades that we even have any good information on what the underwater labyrinth really is. You see, the first person to really lay it on the line, I guess, and shine any light on those holes was a Canadian diver by the name of Dr. George Benjamin. In the 1960s, Dr. Benjamin made first an aerial survey of the cave system, and then later he went back to dive into their dark depths and their twisting arms with diving gear. It is from these dark, ominous, and oddly inviting submerged caves that a local legend sprang up. The peoples of the island have long spoke of a monstrous creature said to inhabit the blue holes of this island. The beast, known only as Luska. The Luska is described as a gigantic animal, over 75 feet in length, 23 meters, and resembles something like you would see in a sci-fi channel movie or an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000. See, it's described by those lucky enough to see it and escape as a cross between an octopus and a shark, with multiple whipping tentacles and a gaping mouth full of jagged shark's teeth. The story tells that this abomination of nature lurks deep in the blue hole caves during the day and comes out of its depths at night to hunt. Witnesses have reported that the Luska will stealthily and suddenly reach up from under an unsuspecting swimmer and with a quick whip of its tentacles slip them beneath the waves, leaving nothing but bubbling water behind. It's reported that the monster drags its victims, or prey, however you see it, down into the darkness of the underwater caves to feed, and that's why the bodies have never been seen again. The Luska is commonly blamed for missing swimmers and the occasional disappearance of cave divers in the area as well. And locals insist that the Luska will target not only swimmers and divers, but boats as well. It is said that Luska has snatched people off the decks of boats, and there are even some accounts of whole boats being pulled under, leaving only swirling water and loose debris lightly rolling in the waves at the surface. Now, many disappearances of boats over the years have been chalked up as the work of Luska. Fishermen in the area are extremely wary when passing by the blue holes. They often slip past the dark blue dots as silently as possible, as noise is said to attract the aggressive beast. It's even reported to be so dangerous that it will occasionally even come up and grab victims right off beaches. In 2005, an underwater photographer reported being attacked by an enormous octopus that he described as being about 50 feet long. The diver shoved his camera out in front of him in hopes to shield himself from certain death, and he said that the monstrous cephalopod actually snatched the camera out of his hands and slipped back into the darkness of the caves. Another man reported that, knowing the tale of the beast but believing it all a joke, decided to have a relaxing swim near a blue hole right around dusk. He said that he hadn't been in the water long when he was violently yanked underwater, kicking and struggling for the surface, and watching it get further and further from his reach. For some unknown reason, the thing that was holding him released its hold, and the man managed to pull away and drag himself onto the nearby shore. Well, once out of the water and after the adrenaline rush of surviving what was certain death, the man noticed a burning pain on his leg and upper thigh. Well, much to his horror, it's then when he noticed huge sucker marks that spiraled down to his foot. Now, another frightening encounter occurred to a crew of divers that were actually trying to catch this creature. See, at first the crew started to realize that something large and heavy was pulling on the traps that they had set and breaking the lines. Strange, yes, but not enough to deter a seasoned crew, so they pushed on. Only to have something happen that shook even the hardiest of the men to his core. See, this nightmare started when one trap was pulled so hard the boat was actually dragged along by whatever it was on the other end. At a reported speed of 1 knot, the ship's onboard sonar at the time revealed what could only be described as a very large pyramid-shaped creature. After the boat was dragged quite some distance, the men say that the line suddenly went slack and the trap was pulled up. It was then that they saw that it had been mauled and destroyed by what they called some underwater beast. It was at this very moment the crew decided they had had enough and called it a day, and then promptly vacated the area. It doesn't end there, though. You see, Destination Truth, a TV show, they even sent a team into the Bahamas blue holes in search of evidence for the Luska. And while they were there, they had some very unusual activity happen to them. After reaching their diving depth of 150 feet, and in the darkness of the blue hole, they came across a huge, expansive opening in the cave wall. Now, when they found this opening, the crew got startled by pinging sonar contact with something they described as huge in the water with the divers. Show host and team leader Josh Gates, at the same time the crew was witnessing the sonar hit, saw movement from something unimaginably large, which he said he had first taken to be merely part of the wall. Now, even though Josh didn't see the creature clearly, the incident was unnerving enough for the crew to pull a visibly shook and shocked Gates from the water very quickly. Now, not beaten by fear or apprehension, Josh decided to make another dive in a different hole, and this time they descended down 175 feet into the underwater cavern. Again, the crew in the boat up top got strange sonar readings of something large moving through the water. And again, Josh said he saw movement in the murk ahead of where he was at, except this time he felt the water ripple around him and saw bubbles. Now, like the time before, he didn't get a good look at whatever it was. But in addition to the sonar report, the crew's FLIR cameras picked up movement from something very big, and it seemed to be lurking nearby. Now this, along with the sonar reading and Gates' encounter, was enough to shake the entire crew and convince them to shut off all the lights on their boat in fear that they would attract whatever was down there. Even though there was no concrete evidence obtained during these dive trips, the team was able to analyze footage that they had taken and noticed something that looked rather like a large tentacle. They speculated that what was captured on film was perhaps part of some sort of enormous octopus or squid. Now, interestingly enough, there have been reports of giant octopus washing up on shore in the Bahamas. One case, the remains of a huge octopus, was found on a beach on Grand Bahamas Island in 2011. Now, there was only part of this creature found, and it was estimated that the full animal would have probably been around 30 feet in length. But 2011 saw another report of a giant octopus. It had a 12-foot-long, 135-pound specimen was floating offshore, was found by fishermen. But see, due to poor water circulation that leads to severe depletion of oxygen, it is said that these holes are very hostile living environments, yet life somehow finds a way. And surprisingly, diversity has taken into these holes. Some have never been found in other places. There are various types of sea worms and crab and shrimp have been found in these holes, and many of them specially adapted to the conditions there. And the large animals, such as nurse sharks and even sea turtles, have been sighted there also. So, is it possible that a giant squid could find enough to eat living in these deep holes? Is it possible that if it is a giant squid, that it just makes its home here, much like smaller cephalopods do in reefs, and it feels safe hiding in the twisting cave system? Or is it truly a crypto monster in paradise? This doesn't end with the water, y'all. Now, it seems that there's a land creature as well. The land creature I'm talking about is the Chicchárny. The islanders here, they tell a tale of a large mystery bird known locally as the Chicchárny, which is only sighted within the ancient pine forest of Andros Island. Now, the Chicchárny is said to resemble that of an owl, and it's typically described as being around 3 feet tall and covered with very fine feathers. So fine, in fact, that they resemble fur. The Chicchárny is said to have 3 fingers, 3 toes, and large red eyes that are mounted into a head that has the ability to turn around nearly 360 degrees. There is also sometimes a mention of a prehensile tail that witnesses claim helped the birds climb in the trees where they make their homes. You see, that's right, folks. This bird has arms and wings. Separate, it has a tail. It's also reported that their nests are composed of 2 pine trees where the tops have been pulled or tied together. Now, the Chicchárnys have been heavily woven into the folklore of the Andros. The stories tell that the Chicchárnys are elfin-like humanoid creatures that merely resemble birds rather than actual birds. And like most tales of fae or woodland little people, these creatures are known to be very mischievous and even on some occasions, very aggressive. In their folklore, it states that if a traveler happens to come across a Chicchárny, it would be wise and in this traveler's best interest to treat it very kindly. See, those who treat the Chicchárny well and show it respect are said to be rewarded with good luck, while those that don't, or even worse, those that laugh and scoff at the creature, it is said that they meet bad luck and hard times. And they said if the Chick Charney is especially offended, that the creature will violently and forcibly twist the person's neck all the way around. Andros Islanders once were so scared of Chick Charneys that they would carry brightly colored flowers and pieces of cloth in order to charm the creatures and dissuade them from attacking them or causing mischief. Now, maybe you aren't buying this strange crypto story, and heck, I don't blame you. But here's an interesting tidbit of information. Neville Chamberlain, former British Prime Minister, is said to have fallen victim to the Chick Charney's vendetta. At the turn of the century, Chamberlain was commissioned to take over his father's Bahaman plantation and decided to make some changes and produce more land for crops by chopping down all vegetation in sight. Well, understandably, the Chick Charneys, who were said to have lived at the top of any of the trees that where they met, well, they were pretty upset with Chamberlain. And to exact their revenge, the Chick Charneys doomed the plantation, which within a few years was declared a total failure and a major financial loss for the Chamberlain family. Some even say that Neville Chamberlain's inability to stop Hitler from attacking England during World War II was also due to his disrespect of the Chick Charneys. Interestingly enough, though, the creature may have an actual basis. In fact, folks, see, Andros was once the home of a large, flightless species of owl that its descriptions very closely match that of a Chick Charney in both the size and the appearance. See, the owl was called a Tytopolan, and it was a large, they said roughly a meter tall, or 3.3 to 3.5 feet, and it was a burrowing owl related to the barn owl, and it once inhabited Andros Island, and it coexisted with earlier colonial settlers. And that was until it went extinct in the 16th century due to destruction of habitat by the new settlers and overhunting. Now, even though the Taito was flightless, it was not known to be arboreal. They never knew it to live in trees, folks, and its similarity in appearance and historical presence on the island mean that a surviving population could and might still exist on this island. Or could it simply be the accounts of misidentification of everyday animals? Or could it be what the villagers told the earlier settlers so that they would leave them alone and not overhunt them and not go into places that they didn't want them? We don't know. But if these accounts were simple misidentification of everyday animals that the locals were always in contact with, and in order to explain certain strange happenings on the island, they turned it to some strange crypto folklore, I could understand. Or is it possible that there were, or better yet, still are something to these stories? And we just refuse to believe that we don't know everything. In closing, I've got this story I want to leave y'all with, and it's a small article from the New York Post from May of 2016. Famed angler Jeremy Wade has embarked on a mission to hunt down the Luska. In an episode of River Monsters airing May 5th at 10 p.m. on Animal Planet, Wade plunges into the inky depths of Luska's rumored lair to find out whether the sea beast is myth or reality. And Jeremy had this to say, and I like this, folks. He says, "My investigation now centers on whether a giant octopus could potentially catch and consume a person." Well, folks, I think we all agree that that could possibly happen, given the size of an octopus and how long it had to eat you. But his last little bit is the part that I like. "I've seen this animal's amazing predatory behavior, so I know in principle this is a possibility."
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. An interesting group of cryptids. I wasn't aware of there being anything cryptic, cryptid-like in the Caribbean, in Bahamas, and places like that. So it seems like no matter where you go on this planet, at every corner, every nook and cranny of this earth, there are these crypto tales, right?
Mm-hmm.
No matter where you go. And I like that show, River Monsters or whatever. Mm-hmm. I like that guy.
I like Destination Truth, too.
Yeah, and I have not seen the episode that you were talking about.
Mm-mm.
But I do like that show, and I think it's pretty interesting. He's actually expanded to like fishing now in the ocean and stuff, which
yes.
I was glad because for a long time they released that, and they just kept re-airing the thing for like 3 years, it seemed like. I'd see it on, oh, I want to check. Oh, man, I've seen this. Oh, man, I've seen it. And
yeah.
It just kept going. But now it actually looks like they're I think they shot themselves in the foot when they named it River Monsters. I think they've soon realized that it's successful, but now, crap, we've already caught everything in the river.
Exactly.
Instead of being like Water Monsters or
yeah.
something. But even with the tagline River Monsters, they're pressing forward. You know, I like these stories because, especially when it comes to the water, because there's just so much we don't know in the ocean that could be there. And I know you're terrified of the ocean, so I won't even ask you if you ever think about diving in one of those blue holes.
No way.
No, I know. But
I want to go see it, though. I want to go to the Bahamas. I want to go see these places. But the idea of even just swimming around there, planet, especially now with that seed planted in my head, there's no way that's going to happen.
Would you kayak fish over a blue hole?
Well, that's what the message was sent to me about when this all got the ball rolling was, hey, would you go kayak fishing? Because I have seen these in the whole thing. And you know what? Probably not. Honestly, probably not. And it's not like they're small either. You know, we're not talking about something that's, you know, just a little old bitty spot, maybe 30 foot around or so. You know, they're pretty good size holes.
Right.
That's out there, which is odd to me about how they were made. You know, there's always these crazy ideas of volcanic tubes and stuff, you know, and the things that made them. Something about the idea. Now, look, the Luska being a part octopus, part shark, you know, it's, I hope it's not real. I mean, that is a total nightmare. I hope that's not a real thing.
You just gave the writer of Sharknado 5 a new idea.
Right. But the idea of there being a giant squid in these holes, and that's what I wanted to bring up, is the idea of, like, when you see the squid, if you watch any documentary on cephalopod and squid and octopus and all that, where they hide, the octopus find the ways to, let's not say it's a squid, let's say it's a giant octopus.
Right.
So it's always trying to hide itself in something. You know, you see it carrying around, like the one was hiding in a bottle in one documentary that I saw. And so why wouldn't a giant one? It's harder for it to hide until it finds a place for it to fit in. It's got to get in where it fits in. And then that's where it is, in this cave system. And it's in and out of there. Well, it's the biggest, baddest thing in the cave system. And if there's other animals coming and going, it's speaking of nurse sharks and things like that, it's going to have to pass right in front of it, much like what Gates saw when he saw this expansive hole, and then he saw something move. There's a good chance something was laying up on these ledges in these, and it just reaches out and takes what it wants when
right.
it comes by. So that being said, it's almost, I can lend a lot of credibility to there being giant squid or octopus in these holes.
Right, which would lead to people creating these stories, and over
yes.
time, they're retold and retold, they get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Crazier,
next
yeah.
next thing you know, it's the size of a school bus. And
well, if you
know,
saw something eat on by a squid with its big beak mouth and it chewed pieces off, it would look like a shark had chewed on part of that before it was released and things. And the guy, I want to believe the guy with the story where he had huge suction cup marks on his legs.
I believe that's real.
You know, you see that, you're like, dude, that's just... Now, the Chicchani, it seems like we talked about that it's almost like they were describing those owls.
Yeah.
And
I
maybe
agree.
Those owls, but also too, then also think in the back of my mind too, we talk about the owls and people seeing them and they have alien gray encounters or whatnot. Maybe there was woodland people that resembled these owls. I mean, there's so much in our history that I want you want to brush off and move on, but there's you got to keep a little bit, even if it's 1%. If you're 99% sure that it's all a lie, that 1%, you got to keep your mind open just in case that was real.
I'm 100% with you. Very cool. Well, Cam, why don't you tell them about Unusual Encounters one more time, just in case there's somebody that's not aware of what we've been doing. We've been working on a totally new project.
We've been having a blast, folks. And like we said, and thank you for everyone that's been participating. They keep flooding in. Keep them coming, folks. We have been doing a YouTube channel show. Now, for those of you that know, we've been pumping this show out. Every time we pump one out here, we release it on YouTube also. So we have a YouTube audience. But this is, first and foremost, a podcast, folks. But aside from that, we started doing one that's YouTube only. And it's video and audio. It's going to be the video of us in studio. And we're going to be discussing listener stories, and we call it Unusual Encounters. It's up there right now. If you want to get more, you want to hear more of a listener story, usually we do one per episode, and we discuss it. Depends on how it goes. We may end up getting to do more than one. We may do two or three. We don't know yet. Like I said, we're just getting the ball rolling. We're just working with the cameras and getting things the way we like it. But if you're interested and you want to submit your story, email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. And in the subject header, in all caps, if you will, please, put Unusual Encounters. And then share your story. And then we'll take it and use it. And if it's one we really enjoy, of course, you know, we're going to use it. Also, too, if you haven't already, jump over there to YouTube and subscribe. Even if you listen on Facebook and you don't, iTunes, and you don't have an account, jump over to YouTube, build you an account. It's free. You can subscribe and you'll be able to catch all the Unusual Encounters shows as we release them. Right now, we're trying to release them every 2 weeks is what we're shooting for. It just depends with work and everything like that, but we're trying to get them out on a regular basis because we enjoy doing it. So if you folks, you want to get involved, you want to be part of it, the whole thing, you can jump over there and also too. And please, if you haven't already, jump over to iTunes, and I know in all the other countries is helping out. We're pushing for the 400 mark here in the U.S., folks. If you haven't already given us a review on iTunes, please do so. And if you don't have an iTunes account, go wherever you can review the show, wherever you download and listen and review the show. If there's a way to review it, please give us a review. Please, we're looking to build that up because it keeps us kind of current. It keeps us up at the top and keeps everybody finding the show.
That's right. And if you don't want to email the show a story or encounter of your own, you can call the show, 817-945-3828. Cam, do you have any big plans for the week?
Nope. This week, I'm going to be busy.
That's me, man.
This week, I'm going to be slammed. So I don't think I have time to look up. So this week's not going to be. Most every week at work, I have a great time. There's a few weeks, you know, out of a few months here and there that's not. This is going to be one of those ones I'm going to be really, really busy getting ready for budget. We have our budget coming, you know, for work. Through the municipality that I work for. So I have a lot of stuff I've got to do with that. Got to get things squared away. Got to, you know, they want to know where you spent all that money, where it went, why it went there and all that. So yeah, I'm fixing to be under the gun and on the carpet for a little while. So that's not going to be fun.
Good. Keep you out of trouble.
Right? Exactly.
Well, that's about all the time we have for today's show. For all you elite members, we'll be speaking to you again on Thursday. For everybody else, please take care. Be safe. Give someone a hug. And we'll talk to you next Monday. For Pretty Lights, Inner Tradition Books, New Page Books, Warwick & Associates, Llewellyn Books, and Ancient American Magazine, I'm Kyle Filson, and he's Cam Hale.
Remember, folks, all you need is love. Peace.